Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about the 1916 Easter Rising in Dublin during the First World War. Ireland is a topic that on this podcast so far we haven't really delved into particularly, but an understanding of Ireland and the politics of Ireland is fundamental really to understanding both Ireland and Great Britain in the 20th century. The two have a kind of an inextricable relationship, and it's a dynamic relationship with one another. So let's start really before the First World War. In the run-up to the First World War, there was a strong sense that a civil war was about to break out in Ireland. The July crisis is the only thing that really diverts the interests of the newspapers away from the issue of Ireland, as the Ulster Unionists armed themselves and prepared to fight against the possibility of Home Rule from Dublin. Home Rule, the Third Home Rule Bill, which had been proposed by the Liberal government, was meeting with stiff resistance from Sir Edward Carson's Ulster Volunteers, and also from within the ranks of the Liberal Party itself. There had already been a split with the Liberal Unionists joining with the Conservative Party, and there were still those who were loyal to Asquith's government objecting to the possibility of Home Rule. Home Rule meaning, obviously, that there would be a Irish Parliament with devolved powers in Dublin, and that Ireland would probably adopt something of a status akin to a dominion, much like Canada, Australia, staying within the British Empire. Popular attitudes across Ireland are remarkably unrevolutionary in most of the Catholic South. The Home Rule is a desired outcome, largely because the consequences of having London, a distant indirect rule for Ireland, have been fairly catastrophic in the past. Events such as the famine and in the 1840s, and the ongoing crisis over landlessness amongst many of Ireland's rural poor are inextricably related to the phenomena of absentee landlords and absentee MPs, who, you know, the Anglo-Irish class of aristocrat who spends most of his time in the Pall Mall Club in London. So having direct rule in Ireland is something that is desired, but there is very little desire for a republic. There is very little desire for any kind of rebellion, revolution, rejection of the monarchy, and most Irish are content really to keep the British crown as head of state. And in 1914, the majority of members of the Irish Volunteers, who are the Catholic equivalent of the Ulster Volunteers, who number about 200,000, nearly 85 to 90% of these enlist and go and fight for the British Army in the Irish Division, and the Ulster Volunteers volunteer in the Ulster Division. And these are men who wind up fighting side by side at the Battle of the Somme. And the reason why so many Irish volunteers, these are armed men who are committed to either a devolved or even an independent Ireland, so many of them decide to go and fight, is that an issue that really speaks to them is the issue of the rights of small nations. Now, this is something that is very large in the press in 1914. Both Serbia, that's been invaded by Austria, and Belgium, that's been invaded by Germany. Belgium is a particularly important case in sort of Irish sensibility because it's like Ireland is a Catholic country. Both these represent small countries that are occupied by large belligerent powers. And there's an obvious kind of resonance for many Irish, and they... many Irish young men believe that at the end of the war, a settlement will be reached whereby small countries will, in general, no longer be conquered by large aggressor states. And there is, in the eyes of many Irish young men, the opportunity for a free and independent, or at least a devolved Ireland, by fighting in the war. The war can bring this to pass. And so therein lies a lot of the motivation for many Irish Catholics going to fight. The Irish volunteers who stay behind, about 10 to 15,000 of them, extraordinarily are not disarmed. They are allowed to keep their arms, and the Ulster volunteers in the north are allowed to keep their arms. Both the British and the Germans during the war were quite keen on destabilising one another. The British obviously used the Arab Revolt to destabilise the Ottomans, and the Germans believed that they could use Ireland to destabilise the British. The Anglo-Irish nationalist Sir Roger Casement, a British diplomat, visited Berlin during the war and proposed to them that they commit troops and guns to creating a revolt in Ireland. And the Germans toy with him, really. I don't think they ever really take the plan seriously. They suggest that it has possibilities. And I think in their view, whilst it might be a good idea, or might be desirable to cause an uprising in Ireland and devote many tens of thousands of men away from the Western Front, I don't think they ever think it stands a chance of possibility, and certainly it doesn't. He attempts to raise an Irish regiment from Irish prisoners of war, and he's largely mocked and derided by them. They are far more anti-German than they are anti-British. He really returns to Ireland empty-handed. The ship that returns to Ireland, supposedly be carrying arms on behalf of the Germans, I don't think it carried really a sufficient amount, was intercepted by the British, and Roger Casement was landed on the Irish coast by a German submarine, where he's promptly arrested and charged with treason. Now, at this point, Casement offers the British an opportunity to reach out to the rebels and tell them not to raise their weapons against the British Crown, because he knows that the rebellion is going to fail. There aren't German troops on the way to back it up. The arms have been intercepted, and there is no chance that it can succeed. The story goes that the British knew of this and allowed the rebellion to go ahead anyway. The rebellion is planned for Easter Sunday, but on Easter Sunday, nothing happens. The majority of Irish volunteers keep a low profile and stay out of any kind of direct activism, but a small group who are completely uncoordinated with the rest of the movement and who don't have any kind of direct leadership from the hierarchy of the Irish Volunteers, rise up in Dublin on Easter Monday and declare a republic by seizing the post office. The subsequent attempts to take Dublin back kill hundreds of civilians and a good hundred or so British soldiers. And the siege is finally ended when the British sail a warship up the River Liffey into Dublin Bay and train its guns on the enclave of the rebels. And the majority of the Irish population don't support the uprising. The majority of the Irish population disapprove immensely. Why? Not because they are all ardent royalists, but because their sons, their brothers, their relatives are fighting on the Western Front, and this is not the time for rebellions back at home. So the British have a propaganda gift.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Handed to them, and they absolutely squander it. The general on the ground, General Maxwell, decides, independent of London, independent of the War Cabinet, that he's going to carry out court-martials and summary executions. And 15 of the rebels are executed. Another about 3,500 people are arrested, most of whom are let go in the end. And a good 1,500 of the Irish Volunteers are interned in camps in England and Wales. And this is a wonderful opportunity for them all to get together and network with one another and start to plan the next uprising, even before they had arrived at their destinations in England and Wales. They were thinking about when the next uprising could come. And the next uprising really is presented to them in 1918. The war ends in November. There is an election in December, of which in Ireland the new radical nationalist party, Sinn Féin, sweep the majority of seats. The old Irish Parliamentary Party, who have been seen as rather complacent ever since the demise of Charles Stuart Parnell, are really forced to the margins of Irish politics, and Sinn Féin instead are the voice of the new Irish nationalisms. The result of this resounding victory is the declaration of the first Dáil, or Parliament, in Dublin, and the declaration of Ireland as an independent country. The nature of the victory means that there is a nationalist government, a nationalist, separatist, independence-motivated government, and really a conservative, with a small c, business-as-usual administration that seems to be working at a huge disconnect from the radical political changes that are happening. At the same time, the Irish Volunteers and the Irish Republican Brotherhood and a number of other Irish nationalist organisations, armed organisations, fuse together into the Irish Republican Army. And the Irish Republican Army operates really at a distance from and out of the effective control of the Dáil. So the Irish Republican Army doesn't take any hesitation, doesn't waste any time in attacking the institutions of British power, the army, the Royal Irish Constabulary, and anything else that really resembles authority in the government and the state. So from 1919 onwards, Ireland is plunged into a war of independence. And again, it's questionable whether it has the broad mandate that perhaps romantic Irish nationalism suggests. Certainly it's a lot more popular since the Easter Rising. One of the results of the disasters of Maxwell's decision during the Easter Rising is that all of a sudden the sympathies of the majority of the Irish Republic, the Irish public, I beg your pardon, shifts towards the rebels. Had it not been for the decision to carry out these arbitrary executions and mass arrests, there would have been little chance that there would have been much appetite for separatism really up to that point. By 1918, yeah, sentiments are different. However, the question as to whether the IRA have a broad mandate to do what they do is very doubtful. They have about between 3,000 and 5,000 active members, obviously working in plain clothes, carrying out ambushes, assassinations, the kind of guerrilla warfare that the British have only really experienced during the Boer War, and then not on quite the same scale and not to quite the same effect. The problem that the British have is that they very quickly get drawn into a counter-insurgency strategy, which is an absolute PR disaster and a strategic blunder. Winston Churchill, as the Secretary of State for War, decides that the Royal Irish Constabulary needs auxiliaries, it needs extra pairs of hands, and so so auxiliaries are drafted, and they are nicknamed, of course, the Black and Tans. These are men who wear the khaki of the army, but due to army shortages and due to uniform shortages, they have to wear the black or the navy blue of the police, and the combination of their uniforms makes them synonymous with extrajudicial killings, punishment killings, the burning of houses when a black and tan or an RIC man is killed, and the use of torture and the use of indiscriminate violence against communities where it is suspected that there might be IRA men present. So the use of the black and tans appalls not only the Irish, but the British government, senior figures in both the opposition and the government itself are horrified by what's happening. Even senior army officers, looking at the indiscipline and the violent brutishness of the black and tans, who are very often made up of either unemployed men who never made it into the army to see the war, or demobbed soldiers who have had 4 years in the trenches and have a lot of anger issues to work out. So the PR disaster, really, and I'm speaking very 21st century terms there, I know, but the PR disaster that the Black and Tans present is one of the kind of the nails in the coffin of Britain's Ireland. And one of the results of the series of mistakes that the British make during the War of Independence is the Anglo-Irish Agreement that comes into effect in January 1922. And the Anglo-Irish Agreement helps to secure for Britain the six counties of Ulster, which Lloyd George himself, I think, was less than keen on retaining. And the rest of Ireland has essentially a dominion status within the British Empire, retaining the king as the head of state, but in the eyes of men such as Eamon de Valera, who becomes the first president of a Irish Free State, this is a grievous crime. And the next period in the story of Ireland really is the Irish Civil War, which lasts up to April 1923, seeing the assassination of the IRA, the pro-treaty IRA leader, Michael Collins, who had done so much really to fight for Ireland and to fight for Irish independence. So I think one of the things that's worthy of drawing from the story of Ireland from 1914 to 1923, over that 9-year period, is not so much the kind of the conventional narrative of revolution and independence, so much as the kind of the impact of the First World War. And I think if we were to look at Europe in a wider sense, the development of nations emerging from the ashes of their empires, from Poland to Czechoslovakia to Hungary and Ireland itself, it forms a kind of like a much larger, much more interesting picture. Ireland really is the product of the First World War, and the Irish Free State is something that emerges as a result. Obviously, Britain is one of the victors in the First World War, and so Ireland isn't created at the Paris Peace Conference, but the consequences really of the war for all powers, victorious or vanquished, were that their empires were tested to the limits, and the loss of Ireland is followed within half a century by pretty much the loss of everything else. And the independence movements in places such as India keenly observed what was happening in Ireland, and Ireland itself was one of Gandhi's most interesting areas of reading. So I hope you find that useful and interesting. I'll be uploading some new things to the Explaining History website very shortly. The new titles that are coming out should be due in March. We've got the Chiang Mao and the Battle of China, and the Explaining History Student's Guide to International Relations, 1870-1914. So check those out. And I'll be doing a new book giveaway in the next few podcasts, so tune into that. Anyway, thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.